Today's Monday, December 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, tributes pour in for South Africa's Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu, who died at the age of 90.
Tutu was far more than a spiritual leader. He spent his life advocating for civil rights and speaking out against injustice, corruption, and oppression.
Bodies of more than a dozen migrants who drowned trying to cross the Mediterranean to Europe wash up on Libya's coastline.
That's an example of a sad reality, is that it's quite a risky adventure to go on a small flimsy boat and then make the journey.
And the aid group Save the Children says two of its staff are missing in a massacre in eastern Myanmar that left more than 30 people dead. We have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Russian President Vladimir Putin says he will ponder a slew of options if the West fails to meet his push for security guarantees, precluding NATO expansion to Ukraine. Earlier this month, Moscow submitted draft security documents demanding that NATO deny membership to Ukraine and other former Soviet countries and roll back its military deployments in Central and Eastern Europe. Putin has urged the West to move quickly to meet the demands, warning that Moscow would take, quote, adequate military technical measures, unquote, if the West continues what he calls, quote, its aggressive, unquote, course, which he says is, quote, on the threshold of our home, unquote. The U.S. and its allies have refused to offer Russia that kind of guarantee on Ukraine that Putin wants, citing NATO's principle that membership is open to any qualifying country. They have agreed, however, to launch security talks with Russia next month to discuss its concerns. Putin says the meeting with the U.S. will be held in Geneva, and parallel negotiations are also set to be held between Russia and NATO, and broader discussions are expected under the aegis of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. Putin has reaffirmed that NATO membership for Ukraine or the deployment of alliance weapons there is a red line for Moscow that it would not allow the West to cross. Tributes are pouring in for South Africa's Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu, who died Sunday at the age of 90. The Nobel Peace Laureate was known worldwide for anti-apartheid activism and a champion of human rights. Linda Giftash reports from Johannesburg.
South Africa's last living Nobel Peace Laureate, Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu, has died at the age of 90. Tutu was far more than a spiritual leader. He spent his life advocating for civil rights and speaking out against injustice, corruption, and oppression. Thabo Mbeki is the Anglican Archbishop of Cape Town.
He wanted every human being on earth to experience the freedom, the peace, and the joy that all of us could enjoy if we truly respected one another. And because he worshipped God, he feared no one. He named wrong wherever he saw it and by whomever it was committed.
Tutu was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1984 for his activism against South Africa's racist apartheid regime. When Nelson Mandela was released from prison, Tutu housed him on his first night of freedom. The Archbishop then presented Mandela to the public as the country's first black president in 1994. Tutu was at the helm of the country's healing process after apartheid, chairing the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where many horrific accounts of injustice were heard. Despite the hardships he confronted, Tutu is remembered for his peaceful activism and ability to forgive. Parliamentarian Patricia DeLille spoke to reporters about her memories of the Arch as he was known.
Humor and a great sense of timing were amongst the Arch's greatest assets. He had an extraordinary ability to diffuse tension, contain anger, and remind people of their human essence. He used humor to convey important messages and had that particular, like we all know, contagious love.
After his retirement at the age of 79, he continued speaking out on ethical and moral issues from xenophobia to LGBTQ+ rights to climate change. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has called him a patriot without equal and a man of extraordinary intellect, integrity, and invincibility. Details of his funeral have not yet been announced. Tutu is survived by his wife, children, siblings, and their families. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Dr. Mamphila Rafili is the acting chairperson of the Archbishop Desmond Tutu Intellectual Property, or IP, Trust, and coordinator of the Office of the Archbishop. She worked with Bishop Tutu as a young activist on the Black Consciousness Movement in the 1970s. She recalls Dr. Tutu's humble beginnings and what inspired his activism.
He is a man who was called to the priesthood because he's a deeply spiritual person, but was called to be a prophet for social justice. And he never stopped, but he became even more public in his engagement with activism when he was the SACC Secretary General. That was at the height of the apartheid brutality. And he made sure that no way would people believe that the church that he led through the SACC would be silent when God's people were being humiliated.
And how did his activism affect his work as a cleric?
It enhanced his work as a cleric. He got, I mean, when I first met him, we were young activists of the Black Consciousness Movement, and he came to visit us in King Williamstown, where we had our first big community project, and I was the medical officer in charge of Zanempilo Community Health Center. Because he wasn't au fait with what we were talking about the need for mental liberation from mental slavery. Mm. And when we talked through that, he could see it immediately. So he was a great supporter of this healing of the humiliation of the past, the assertion of one's dignity because you are God's creature, but also the ungodliness of discrimination in whatever form, right, whether it was on the basis of racism, sexism, or homophobia, or xenophobia, all wrong. And so he had this coherence of values that exemplified what Ubuntu is. And he understood it and lived it.
That's Dr. Mamphele Rafile, acting chairperson of the Archbishop Desmond Tutu IP Trust and coordinator of the Office of the Archbishop, speaking with my colleague, Jackson Mvunganyi. Libya's Interior Ministry and the local Red Crescent said the bodies of more than a dozen migrants who drowned trying to cross the Mediterranean to Europe have washed up on Libya's coastline. Libya is the major transit point for migrants, many from African countries, who are seeking better opportunities in Europe. The Red Crescent in the western Libyan port of Khums says 17 bodies, including that of an infant, were recovered from the shores at nearby Alous on Saturday, and that another 10 bodies have been found on a different beach. The Interior Ministry says 14 bodies have been recovered from a group of 60 believed missing at sea. For more, I spoke with reporter Ruud Ermenda, who had covered several migrant rescue operations.
That's an example of a sad reality is that it's quite a risky adventure to go on a small, flimsy boat and then make the journey usually to the island of Lampedusa, because that's Italy, and that's 300 kilometers. So you have to imagine it's a small boat that maybe goes 20 kilometers per hour. So you're looking at least 15 hours of going over the sea with a small boat with many people. And often the engine breaks down or the fuel finishes, something happens, or the boat gets in disorder because it starts deflating. So if you look all of that, then it's very high chance that a very tragic event like this happens, and it happens, and it's not always reported, and now suddenly it is, and that's a very sad thing that happened.
Could this tragedy have been prevented?
That's very difficult, because you're talking about a very big area, and so the only prevention would be is to stop boats departing, but that's not realistic. People just want to go to Europe, or they see it as the only way out. So the only way to overcome tragedies like this is to stop migration, but that's not something which is realistic.
What about cracking down on those who are responsible for carrying these migrants, the boat operators, those who are paid to ferry these migrants across? Can't something be done about that?
Yeah, but that would involve a very serious effort from within Libya. And that currently the government is not really strong. There are several factions active, and the guys who are operating those small boats, they often work in conjunction with local landlords. So they also have some kind of security details themselves. So it's an apparatus within Libya. And that's one thing, because it's fed by the big wish of migrants of going to Europe. Either they want to go to Europe, or they see a ship out of Libya as the only way out of the situation they are. So you can crack down on those small ships, but they will find ways to do it because the demand is there. So as long as the demand is there, the migration will continue one way or another.
Do you think this latest tragedy will deter or slow down the flow of migrants?
That question is often being asked also in relation to rescue operations exacerbating the number of migrants choosing to go to sea because they hope to be rescued. But what you see is when the ships are not there, like for example when COVID-19 started, there was not so much traffic on the sea anymore in terms of ships and rescue boats, is that the migrants kept coming, even though they knew very well that the chance to be rescued was very little, but they still went. They still went. The wish to move out is so big that it's stronger than any factual report you get.
That's reporter Ruth Elmendrop speaking with me from Nairobi. Greece's Coast Guard say at least 16 people have died and another 63 were rescued when their boat overturned on the island of Poros in the central Aegean Sea in the third marine disaster involving migrants this week. Authorities scrambled a search and rescue operation overnight northwest of Paros. The Coast Guard says air and sea assets were deployed to the area. A video released by the Coast Guard shows the migrant boat sunken beneath the sea. The country's semi-official Athens news agency says the bodies of 12 men, 3 women, and an infant have been recovered from the area. The 63 rescued have been taken to shelter on Paros Island, while some receiving first aid treatment. 80 people are believed to have been on the vessel, which Coast Guard says is believed to have been headed for Italy from Turkey. The U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments early next month about the Biden administration's vaccine mandates for workers at larger companies, but analysts say a patchwork of rules in different locations could lead to confusion before then. Associated Press correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
There have been contradictory court rulings in different jurisdictions on President Biden's plan to require that workers at companies with 100 or more employees be vaccinated against COVID-19 or undergo weekly testing and be required to wear a mask. That's why the Supreme Court will be asked to decide. But until then, OSHA says the vaccination mandate will take effect January 10th. There's also a challenge to the requirement healthcare workers at facilities that accept federal funding will all have to be vaccinated. Legal challenges have blocked that rule in half of the states, but not the other half. Legal experts don't think the nation's highest court would put the mandates on hold unless it moves quickly to reverse one court ruling and then expand two preliminary injunctions. I'm Jackie Quinn.
A neighborhood in the New York City borough of Brooklyn is stunning visitors with its spectacular Christmas lights. The Dyker Heights neighborhood boasts some of the most over-the-top holiday displays. Elena Wolf takes us there in this story narrated by Anna Rice.
It's one of New York City's most stunning and magically decorated neighborhoods during the holiday season. Brooklyn's Dyker Heights neighborhood has united people for 3 decades with its spectacular lights display. Ron bought a house in Dyker Heights in 2014. Each Christmas since then, he has gotten more garlands, lights, and extension cords.
There is no vision. Everybody is expressing themselves a different way. Some people have white lights, some people have colored lights. I have nativity, which I'm going to put tomorrow. The true meaning for us is the birth of Jesus. So that's what is going to be the centerpiece of my display.
Respecting the unspoken neighborhood rule, Ron continues the tradition that was started by his neighbor, the local Mrs. Klaus, Lucy Spada. VOA spoke with Spada in 1986,
I moved here, and it was done in memory of my mother. And it started very small. I was the only house that did it on this block. And then it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. First, everybody complained about it, but then everybody chipped in, you know, everybody, you know, put into it, and it became bigger than...
And Christmas.
Yeah, it got big. I never thought it would.
After a quiet year in 2020 due to COVID-19, tourists and locals, protected with vaccines, boosters, and masks, have found their way back to the bright and jolly lights of Dyker Heights. Angels, nutcrackers, polar bears, and of course reindeer. Dyker Heights is not afraid of being too big, imaginative, or magical. This house is decorated in honor of Michael, a teen who has muscular dystrophy. He says this house belongs to a neighbor who has helped him raise over $2 million for muscular dystrophy research. A neighborhood that continues to bring hope and joy, even in the most difficult of times. For Eliana Wolf in New York, NRI's VOA News.
A suggestion by Australia's most popular state to charge unvaccinated people for COVID-19 medical costs is receiving widespread criticism. The New South Wales proposal is angering doctors and some federal politicians who argue that health care in Australia is free and universal. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The New South Wales government has said that unvaccinated patients being treated for COVID-19 have been irresponsible and have burdened taxpayers with very substantial costs, and they could be forced to pay for their hospital care. State Transport Minister David Elliott.
There already is two classes of hospital system, because you've got the unvaccinated that are there because they haven't been taking responsibility for their actions, and you've got the vaccinated there who have got a genuine requirement for healthcare.
But members of Australia's federal government have been sceptical about making unvaccinated COVID-19 patients pay for their treatment. The Australian Medical Association said the proposal was unethical, and it doubted that it was even legal. The president of the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners, Dr. Karen Price, told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that it would affect disadvantaged communities.
We might make all sorts of judgments on people who smoke or have an unhealthy lifestyle, and the unvaccinated would be a large cohort of those people might have low health literacy. And we know in some of our Indigenous communities where vaccination rates are low, this would be an unethical procedure to implement.
90% of eligible Australians are fully vaccinated. On Thursday, New South Wales recorded 5,715 COVID-19 cases, a new daily record for any Australian jurisdiction during the pandemic. Testing clinics have been overwhelmed as Australians rush to be screened ahead of Christmas. A negative result is required for travel between various states and territories. Western Australia has become the first jurisdiction to introduce mandatory COVID-19 booster shots for certain sections of its population. It's also reintroducing internal border controls with Tasmania and the Northern Territory to try to curb the spread of the Omicron variant. Entry into Western Australia from other parts of the country will be prohibited without an exemption. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
In other news, the international aid group Save the Children says two of its staffers are missing in a massacre in eastern Myanmar that left more than 30 people, including women and children, dead and burned in their vehicles. This after they were reportedly shot by government troops as they were fleeing combat. Photos of the aftermath of the Christmas Eve killings in Mawson Village in Kaya State has spread on social media and fueled outrage against the military that took power in February after ousting the elected government of Aung San Suu Kyi. The accounts could not be independently verified. The U.S. Embassy in Myanmar says it's appalled by what it calls, quote, the barbaric unquote attack in Kaya State that killed at least 35 civilians, including women and children. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We're on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afua in Washington. Africa's Sahel region is plagued by terrorism and conflict, a crisis exacerbated by the devastating effects of climate change on farmers and animal herders. Harry Wilkins reports from Burkina Faso.
The Sahel extends almost 6,000 kilometers, 3,700 miles along the southern edge of the Sahara, from the Horn of Africa on the east to the western Atlantic coast. There's little rainfall in the Sahel, and farmers struggle to eke out a living in some of the harshest agricultural conditions on Earth. As climate change brings more intense droughts and degrades land in the Sahel, intercommunal violence over dwindling resources has increased. Much of the conflict is between herders and farmers who vie against each other to use the land for their own purposes. Some in the region have joined terrorist groups, militants linked to Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, who ride into villages on motorbikes and attack civilians indiscriminately. They wreak havoc and make parts of the region uninhabitable for civilians. While weak states and lack of development are big factors in the conflict, experts say climate change also plays a part. But it's rarely discussed beyond the level of analysts and warnings from the UN. Unlike terrorists on motorbikes, climate change is a cause of the conflict people on the ground cannot see. It is there. We travelled to Dori in northeastern Burkina Faso, where people are living on the front line of war and climate change. We wanted to find out how the invisible enemy of climate change is affecting people's lives and driving them from their homes. But first, we had to get there. Dori is the capital of Burkina Faso's war-torn Sahel province and home to thousands displaced by the conflict. The road from Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso's capital, to Dori is dangerous because of IEDs and pop-up terrorist checkpoints. Just 5 kilometres outside Dori, terrorists have attacked civilians and UN vehicles multiple times this year. Bagai Lamizana grew up in Burkina Faso. Today she's based in Bonn, Germany, as project officer for the United Nations Convention to Combat Desertification.
Climate change is a kind of invisible enemy in the Sahel conflict. UK Ministry of Defence say that 60 million people will migrate from degraded land, part of Africa, if nothing is done. I think neighbouring countries and Europe can see this migration affecting them.
Migration manifests itself in different ways in the Sahel. Some people, as farming becomes impossible, move to the cities in hope of finding work. But often they end up with low-paying jobs or living in poverty. Some of those migrants in turn begin to move further afield, often to Europe. They take trafficking routes through Niger, Algeria, Libya, and then take boats across the Mediterranean. The crisis in the Sahel has displaced nearly 3.5 million people, according to the UN. We met Zara Areta, living in a host community on the edge of Dori. She's one of the 1.3 million internally displaced people in Burkina Faso. Zara came to Dori from Arbinda, a town about 60 kilometres away, where extremists regularly terrorised the communities, killing men, women and children. An attack on Arbinda in August left more than 80 people dead. Zara says that tensions between herder and farmer communities have increased, shattering the unity that once existed. Salem is also a migrant who fled terrorism. Like thousands of others in Burkina Faso, he's joined a state-backed militia group known as the Volunteers for the Defence of the Homeland. They act as auxiliaries and local guides for the military, but they've also been accused of carrying out extrajudicial killings against civilians they believe are linked to terrorists. For those who want to fight, it means joining terror groups. Those groups mostly do not have a religious ideology as their primary aim. Instead, they're financially motivated. They're looking for resources to survive.
In Kenya, women from pastoral Maasai community in Taitai Taveta were traditionally not allowed to go out to look for food, as that was responsibility of men. Today, however, the roles have switched as more women go to work and provide for their families while men stay home. Juma Majanga reports from Mungu in Taita Taveta County on what climate change has to do with this shift of gender roles.
In the scorching sun in Nameluk village, on the slopes of Mount Kasgao, women and girls seem to cheer themselves, sheltering under the only available tree shade as they engage in the craft the Maasai are well known for, beading. Beadwork has long been a traditional practice among Kenya's ethnic Maasai community, but it has also become an increasingly important source of income. Miriam Kasumuni is one of the Maasai women who earn their living from beadwork. In the past, she says, our beadwork was not for sale. We used to make them for our own personal use, for beautification. It was not a business. Where would we sell them? She says, we didn't even know that beads could be sold. Who would we sell to? The Maasai's are pastoralists. Their tradition is that men raise the livestock, the main source of income. Johanna Okulai is a Maasai elder and the area chief of Mushirini. He says Maasai women never used to leave home to go work. Their responsibilities were at home, doing chores. He says a man's work was cattle rearing. When the man leaves with the cattle, the woman remains home with the children. Johanna Mapi Kiserian, a Maasai elder, confirms that point of view. He says women were to remain at home and keep watch over things, get milk, cook, and that's all. The man used to take care of everything. But recurring drought from climate change has devastated Maasai herds and changed those traditional gender roles. Here again is Johanna Okulai. He says when a Maasai gets one or two cows and he gets good pasture, within 10 years, that will have multiplied to 50 cows because that is their work. But now, because of climate change, he says, that is very difficult. Conservationists say people are also to blame. Lauren Lenjo is the community relations manager at Wildlife Works, a conservancy organization based in Maungu, Kenya.
There was a lot of slash and burn agriculture in this area. People could just cut down forests. We had our natural water ponds in the forests, but those water ponds have already dried up. We had some rivers which were flowing down from the top of the hill, and that water could stay for a longer time. But these days, those rivers are no longer there. This is because of the change of weather patterns, and it's because people have destroyed the forest.
More than 80% of Kenya is arid and semi-arid and faces the risk of desertification. Johanna Okulai explains the impact on the pastoral Maasai community. He says, you can no longer find a man with more than 100 cows around. I am the village elder with two wives and four daughters-in-law, and I only have about 15 cows left from the more than 100 that I had. He says, now, if I divide these 15 cows among my family members, what will they have? Now, in his 90s, Johanna Mapi Kiserian is witness to drought's impact. He lost 450 out of his 500 livestock to drought. Juma Majanga for VOA News, Maungu, Kenya.
This is Science in a Minute.
Juno is NASA's orbiting mission to Jupiter and its moons. The space agency's Juno team presented the probe's latest findings at the recent American Geophysical Union's fall meeting. Among the highlights offered included the sounds of the Jovian moon Ganymede from data that was gathered as Juno made a close flyby in June 2021. The data that generated these sounds was collected by the spacecraft's WAVES instrument, which is used to monitor electric and magnetic radio waves that are generated within Jupiter's magnetosphere. NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory says that Juno was within 1,038 kilometers of Ganymede's surface during the close flyby and was traveling at a relative velocity of 67,000 kilometers per hour. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Apo in Washington, wishing you a pleasant day.
This is the Voice.
of America. Washington, ba 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 zip.